Hello, and thank you for joining this Medcast series titled Emerging Evidence in the Treatment of Obesity. I am Diana Isaacs, an endocrine clinical pharmacy specialist and the director of education and training in diabetes technology at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio.
And I am Natalie Bellini. I'm an endocrine nurse practitioner, and I'm the program director of diabetes technology at University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio.
In this episode, we will examine the current and upcoming treatments for obesity. To discuss more of this, we are joined by Dr. Ken Fujoka, an endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism specialist in San Diego, California. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's begin. So we're going to dive right into our questions. We're wondering if you could please provide an overview of obesity-associated metabolic disturbances.
So there's actually quite a few. As you know, there's well over 100 documented diseases directly related to obesity. But the real common ones that at least I see, hypertension, diabetes, are very closely linked. So you have all these diseases related to weight, and the heavier you get, pretty much the worse they get.
So can you tell us a little, I guess, specifically about maybe what other conditions are directly or most directly linked to obesity?
I guess the two I would think would be which I just mentioned, hypertension and diabetes. So what happens is as you gain more, and again, you have to gain central fat, but as you gain central weight gain, visceral fat, you begin to release more free fatty acids. So your blood now is full of free fatty acids and glucose, and your cells have a choice. They don't care which one they get for energy. So insulin pushes in both. It's pushing in both fat and glucose in the cell. So you raise your insulin. After a while, you get insulin resistance because your insulin level is higher. And that causes all kinds of problems. Insulin tells the kidneys, hang on to sodium. So your blood pressure starts to go up. Your fat cells make angiotensinogen, so your blood pressure goes up. Because you have this competition, you have less insulin sensitivity. So your blood sugar goes up and you end up with prediabetes. And, you know, that's when the problems start, heart disease, all that. But eventually it'll go on to type 2 diabetes. So there's this whole hormonal cascade that goes on. I mean, there are people, maybe, 15-20% of women who gain their weight peripherally. They don't get that central adiposity and they do fine and they don't get these problems because they gain the weight peripherally. But if you gain the weight centrally, you get a lot of other problems.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. So when you think about this person that is, you know, and we see this in social media, in the news, right? I am overweight or I am obese, but I'm a healthy obese person. Can you talk a little bit about that and your feelings about that? I know this is a very controversial topic.
It is actually. A lot of people feel no matter what, if you're overweight, you're going to be at risk. But actually, no, there are some, again, usually women that are what we call metabolically well. So in other words, they don't get a lot of these problems. Now, they will still get some other issues like something structural like sleep apnea, things like osteoarthritis, the knees and hips, although that's a twofold issue. As you know, sure, there's more weight on the joints, but fat cells release a huge number of inflammatory factors. Those inflammatory factors then make your joints bad, your hips bad, your hands bad. Believe it or not, there's studies going on right now where you just produce weight loss and the osteoarthritis gets better. But with that said, there's a small group that tolerates weight gain relatively well. It's always going to be weight that's lower down. It's going to be in the hips, the thighs. Again, it's not going to be visceral or central.
So that is so interesting. What mm-hmm. determines how a person gains the weight if it's peripheral versus central? And there's anything someone can do to like get the peripheral weight instead of centrally?
Sure. So the best way is to make sure you choose your parents well, because it's pretty much all genetic. So let's say example, the cutoff for obesity in Caucasians is a BMI of 30, which is your weight divided by height squared. So it's just as you get taller, you should get heavier. And so you have these cutoff points. But in the Asian population, it's not 30, it's 25. it's much less. And again, that's because all Asians, men and women, pretty much only gain their weight centrally, very visceral. And so again, they get all these visceral adiposity problems that just mushroom at relatively low weight gains. You know, like we're talking 30 pounds, 35, whereas a Caucasian, African-American, you've got to put on, you know, much more like 50, 60 pounds. So again, it's genetically determined. We don't know how to get the body to put it in one place or the other, but it's pretty much all genetically determined.
That's interesting. So you can't just do like 1,000 sit-ups and get rid of the central weight.
Right, right. So I guess my next question then is, so according to the guidelines, first we always, even with diabetes management, we say lifestyle and behavioral interventions. How long do you typically use that as your basis before you decide to go to either medication or weight loss or, I mean, a surgery, right? What can you talk about your process of just treating people over time that aren't getting to goal?
Okay. So, and we'll probably cover this later on about why it's so hard to lose weight, but we'll start with, you know, obviously lifestyle changes, diet and exercise in just about everybody. But most women have actually tried this and they've been very good at it. They've lost weight before, they, you know, mm-hmm. done very good calorie counting. And again, because of the set point, it goes right back. So it's very frustrating. So we may start meds right away. Visit one. Not every guy, but some men have never tried weight loss before. I'm amazed. I'll get a guy who comes in. He's now 46, 47. He's turning into a diabetic. He's never tried weight loss before. Mainly because, unfortunately, in our society, it's no big deal to be an overweight guy. Our society is really tough right. on overweight women. But if you're a guy, well, it's kind of good. You know, I'm a big guy, and so it's all right until they get medical problems. And so, you know, we talked about comorbid problems. When you look at depression, women, just as soon as they get overweight, they get a little down. They get obese, they get very down. They get morbidly obese, they're very depressed. Guys, it's called the jolly fat man theory. It doesn't bother them. They have to get to a BMI of 35. So we're talking 70, 80 pounds of weight. And all of a sudden they get really depressed because they get all these medical problems and they can't play the things that or do the things they used to do. So it kind of goes along this continuum and just choosing the right, you know, lifestyle, all that. It's got to be in there no matter what you do. But if somebody has medical problems now, pre-diabetes, becoming a diabetic, hypertension, things we know get better with weight loss, we're going to be pretty aggressive at using meds much earlier because the newer meds we have are just so much safer and they don't bother these factors like cardiovascular disease.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about those medications, like what options we have available and how they've kind of evolved over time?
Sure. So I'm an old doctor, you know, near the end of my career. And back in the early 90s, we were looking at, you know, stimulants. We were looking at THC blocker receptors. We were looking at off effects to produce weight loss because we didn't understand why was somebody overweight. And in the, I mean, it's hard to imagine, just as little as 10 years ago, this was really planted and figured out. But we began to realize that there is a set point in the hypothalamus, and it's always trying to get you back to whatever was the highest weight your patient has been to. And the way it does it is through hormonal changes. And the other thing we need to realize is that the endocrine system that controls food intake is turned on 24/7 to eat. It just tells you, yeah, go ahead and eat, 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 feed me. And then when you eat a meal, food gets down into your small intestine and you release various hormones, GLP-1, PYY, and other ones that go to the brain and tell you to stop eating. So the only way to shut the system down is to turn on those cells down in the small intestine. Once we figured that out, we said, shoot, let's just copy those hormones. And now we have those available and they're coming out in groves. You're gonna be giving a cocktail of three or four of these in the next 5 to 10 years. And you'll be able to control weight like we've never seen before.
Wow, that's incredible. So let's circle back now, right? To why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to lose weight?
Okay.
That's and keep it off, right? I mean, that's really the elephant in the room, right? I mean, most people can lose 5 or 10 pounds, right? And they can do it and they go and they're, and then slowly over time they regain, and then they regain even a couple of more, and then they start again. And then, so a lot of people that present to our diabetes and metabolic care center have that story, right? That they've lost weight. I lost in 2010, I lost 50 pounds and then I gained it back. And then in 2014, I lost like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So that's what was figured out about 10 years ago. So big article, New England Journal showed something we had never believed or that we thought wouldn't happen. So let's say we have a guy who's supposed to weigh 160 pounds. He's 5'9". He's got a normal BMI. He gets to a weight of, say, 200 pounds. Either he got put on, say, a beta blocker, or he was on steroids, or he decided he had to study really hard so he'd reward himself with ice cream every night, which is what I did in med school. But he gets overweight, and now his weight's 200. And so, and as you said, tries to lose weight. We'll say he loses 10% of his weight, 20 pounds. And he gets down 20 pounds, and all of a sudden he's really struggling. One thing is he finds he's thinking about food more often. Two, his actual metabolic rate drops 300 calories more than it's supposed to. And what's happening is up in the hypothalamus says, wait a minute, I'm supposed to weigh 200 pounds. It doesn't think 200 pounds is bad. It says, I'm supposed to be there. So what it does is those hormones I said, when you eat a meal and they come up and tell you full, guess what? They don't come up anymore. The hypothalamus downregulates those so that it can be more hungry, and you got to eat more to be satiated. But the scarier part is it also lowers your metabolic rate. So a guy, 200 pounds, you know, young guy, he's probably going to burn about 2,000 calories a day. He's not burning 2,000 calories. He's burning 1,700 every day. That 300 calories he gets, he didn't do anything to deserve it. But again, the hypothalamus is trying to get back to that highest weight. So make a long story short, now that we have these hormones that you're supposed to make, but again, you've suppressed because you're trying to get back to the higher weight, we got the system beat. We can now give it back. The hypothalamus thinks, oh, I'm fine. I don't need to eat. It's okay to keep my weight down. That has just been I didn't think this ever happened in my lifestyle. Mind blowing.
Right. And then, you know, you're talking about someone who got down, has reduced their calories. Now we need to reduce it even more. And then they truly feel deprived, right? And their brain is telling them to eat, and they really need less than they've ever needed since they were, you know, really, really young. And that balance is very difficult. It's a very difficult thing.
Yeah. It is. They have to eat. If you had, say, again, our 200-pound guy, and he is sitting next to another guy who's 180 pounds, or both 180, but one guy's reduced, he's got to eat at least 300 calories less than this guy next to him, which is hard for a bunch of guys to do because they like to go to a bar and eat a bunch of pizza and have a good old time, you know? So this is tough.
It's tough, right?
That's so interesting.
That's how we see that weight, right? That back and forth and back and forth. And can you talk a little bit about that back and forth and what that does to the body, that loss and regain? Do you have any kind of, how do you explain that to a patient, that yo-yoing of up and down? What does that do to the body long-term?
Yeah, and especially thinking of it as it relates to some of these like diet plans, like people who do, for example, ketogenic, which I know some people do long-term, but some people do it for a little bit and then lose weight and gain weight. So like, yeah, how do you talk to patients about those types of things?
We struggle with that one. So first of all, it's really hard to study that group where their weight's going up and down. Because if they're losing weight, well, then their numbers look better. Right. So it comes down to a couple things, but one is age. The other one is how much lean tissue they lose. So again, we'll go back to our 200-pound guy. He loses 20 pounds. He doesn't, I wished he would, lose 20 pounds of pure fat. We're going to talk about some things, though, that can do that, which is, again, totally mind-blowing. But he loses about 5 pounds of lean tissue and about 15 pounds of fat. So if you lose a lot of weight and you lose too much lean tissue, which we used to worry about in the geriatric population, 65 and up, then when they regain the weight, they gain more fat mass back, which is just the last thing you want to do. You really want to keep that lean tissue because that's what determines your metabolic rate. And again, all the other medical problems come with that. With that said, it turns out you probably gain back 5 pounds of lean tissue and 15 pounds of fat mass if you're under the age of 60. Now, if you're over 60, forget it. There's very recent data that just came out, beautiful study, showing that after 60, we really are losing lean tissue like crazy. The other group which loses lean tissue, and you guys can probably predict this, is postmenopausal women. So just about probably anywhere from 2 to 4 years before women have their final menstrual period, that kind of perimenopausal period, you see this rapid increase in fat and this huge drop in their lean tissue. And so, and again, that's because of loss of estrogen. Men, you could do the same thing to a man if you took away his testosterone, but men kind of, it slowly degrades over time. So whatever we can do when we're losing weight is it's very important to hang on to lean tissue. So that's why you're going to see these new recommendations coming out saying, yeah, you got to do weight, you got to do exercise, but you got to add in cardio with resistance training.
Interesting.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the GLP-1 receptor agonists and kind of what we're seeing in terms of the effects on weight in clinical trials and kind of what's been your experience in practice?
Okay. So if we go back to the dark ages, the 90s, when we didn't have anything worth, we were like happy to get 5% weight loss. We got 10. We're going, oh my God, this is the best thing we ever saw.
Right.
If you talk to a patient though, you ask them, how much do you want to lose? They'll tell you, I want to lose 30% of my weight. That's a lot of weight. That's even more than bariatric surgery can do. But if you ask them, well, what would you be happy with? What would be just be the minimal amount? Not what you, oh, you know, you what you really want. And they'll tell you 15%. The newer GLP-1s, the one that's recently approved, the newer ones come down the pipe, they all give up 15% or better. So that's a big deal because one, and that's why we're running out of it. Nobody can make enough of it.
Right.
Which we might want to talk about because it's hard to imagine is 50% of the U.S. population is eligible for weight loss drugs. We have a real problem in the U.S. But to make a long story short, because they're all giving 15%, it's just blown up on social media, friends, word of mouth. So everybody wants these things because they work. And the fact that they're a hormonal base, in other words, it's not an off-target effect. This is what this hormone's designed to do. It's like the safest thing we've seen. So we're just so like, wow, this is mind-blowing. But again, now we've got all the problems that come with it, which is they can't keep it on the shelf.
Right. I think that's a real issue, right? Especially if you've started someone and now they can't get it, or someone comes to you and maybe they've been diagnosed with something else. They've had hypertension or their parent or spouse or someone has a medical issue. So now they're ready and they're ready to start and they're ready to do this. And they've been going to the gym and they've worked with a dietitian and they come to you for medication and you say, I'd love to give it to you maybe in September. Or October, because I don't have any, there isn't any, I don't have samples anymore. That's a real struggle. Are you having that same thing? I mean, we're coming from the East Coast. It's no different where you are, is it?
No, you hit the nail on the head. They're ready. They want to start. Right. They've done everything else. They're good to go. It's like, oh no, I don't have it. So this has been just so tough to deal with. And again, I can't ever remember in my career, I don't know if you folks can, that we ever had this problem where they couldn't make enough of a medication. It was so tough.
I know. And it's an injectable. Yeah. People are running to take an injectable medication.
Right, right. They're happy to do it, right? Right. Yeah. I wish we had this same challenge with people with diabetes taking the same molecule. And they're like, I'm not injecting. But if I say, oh, this is a drug that we use for weight loss as well, they're like, okay, give me three. I'll take three of them, right? I mean, and we're laughing, but it's really hard, right? Because when you're not meeting your in range goals, you don't really feel that poorly. But when you recognize that you want to lose weight, now you're looking at yourself in the mirror and going, I can see it. I can feel it. I can see myself in pictures with my family. I want to lose weight. And it's an active process where they say, let's go. Right. And we as clinicians are telling them, no, it's very difficult. It's been and I do think it's going to resolve eventually. Right.
Yeah.
but it's been a tough couple of years.
Yeah. No, and you hit the right button in that I think the drug companies are pretty sharp and they're realizing, look, we need to make sure that the diabetic population gets it because they need help. They can't tolerate their weight gain, so they're getting medical problems. And then unfortunately for obesity, that's where the shortage is everyone's seeing right now. But again, yeah, a tough one. And it just amazes me because you have all the time at our office, we have folks come in, they're normal weight and they're asking for it. And I go, no, sorry, this is not for you. This is for somebody
right.
who really struggles with weight.
Right. So in addition to the shortage problems, we also have issues with, I guess, with insurance covering it. So I'm curious kind of what your experience has been with the insurance coverage and access.
So it ranges all over the place and it's actually state to state as well. So give me an example, Medicaid, California, we call it Medi-Cal, same thing. It's covered. We're going, what? This is great. And that, yeah, just wow.
Is it covered for weight or for diabetes or for both?
Both.
Wow.
No prior auth, nothing.
Wow. Oh,
you go amazing. To another state, Medicaid wouldn't touch it.
Right.
So
right.
state to state. The other one is then you get into the private insurances, the PPOs, things like that. And now it becomes an employer decision. And believe it or not, Wall Street. Yeah.
Right.
Wall Street.
You have no idea. Right. Right.
And so we're guessing. And I get into my EMR and I try and look it up and it says preferred. No, doesn't work. Or it says not covered. Well, guess what? It is covered. So employer to employer. And I get it. It's probably a pretty big opt-in cost for them. And so some will, some won't. For us in California, it's about 30% is what we're seeing coverage-wise. Right. But I have no idea where we are across the board.
I do. I think you're correct in that state to state. You know, in Ohio, where both Diana and I practice, CGM is covered under Medicaid for everyone with diabetes, doesn't matter what you take. Period. Right. So we can get a CGM at the pharmacy with no prior auth,
but we can't get
weight loss. Yeah. Right. So if we can wait till they develop diabetes, then we can treat them. Right. But I can't treat their obesity ahead of time to prevent the diabetes from ever happening. Right. So it's that, you know, you're trying to get this whole picture to an insurer and say, but if we treated the obesity, we might not end up here.
Right.
If we did this, we might not end up here, right? And it becomes a real issue, right? We are actually ordering some from Canada. And I know, Diana, you and I have talked about this, that we've been ordering, because for people that have to pay the cash price, it's expensive.
Although my understanding is Canada is
it's
not
shutting
happy
down, right?
With
They're
that.
Not happy yes. with it, right? Yeah. People are desperate, especially when you get a coupon for a little bit and then the coupon stops working and you were using it maybe off label for a weight loss when you didn't, your insurance doesn't want to pay for it. So they did for 6 months or a year and now they won't anymore because the coupon stopped working. Those are all real challenges with the medications as a whole, right? Because people try it and they love it. And then what do we do?
Right. So curious, what do we have to look forward to? What's in the pipeline for obesity medications?
Very impressive. So earlier I said we're wired D24/7. When we get food into our small intestine, we release multiple hormones, not just GLP-1, but all types. They go up into the brain and tell us to stop eating. Some of them will actually go to the liver and tell the liver, hey, maybe burn a little fat. So really impressive stuff. So you're going to start seeing pairing of these, which has already happened with tirzepatide, which has paired a GIP with a GLP-1. And again, the more you give, the more weight loss you're going to get. So you're just going to see more and more weight loss. There's even companies now that have what we call triples, and you're using a hybrid molecule with three different hormones that are part of this satiety hormone track and lowering weight. So just amazing. And then earlier I talked about usually you lose some muscle with the fat. There's now one in development, phase two finished. You don't lose any muscle. Matter of fact, you might gain a little muscle.
Wow.
You know, I want to take that stuff. I'm going to be Superman.
Right. Right.
So again, you just cannot get over how the science has just blown up in a very good way. in probably, obviously, the most common problem in the U.S.
And I know you talked about like the importance of exercise and strength training with these drugs. What about the importance, I guess, of diet and stuff? Like, how does that play a role? Do people need to intentionally modify their diet, or kind of, if as long as they're taking the drug, will that be enough?
So it's real clear that, and again, this is tough data to find with these newer drugs, but with the old drugs, and we're pretty certain it'll happen with the current drugs we have, that if you eat better, make better food choices, you will get that much better weight loss. It just makes sense. And what these medications do is they allow you to follow a good diet. It's just so much easier to do that. And the classic is, I had a patient say the other day, gee, is this how normal people feel? In that they can eat a smaller portion, they're satiated. They don't have to go back and get seconds. They don't have to go and get that sweet after they've had dinner. So all those are all kind of like moving in the right direction. But we have another saying in the business. It's called, you can't outrun a bad diet. And so some people say, well, I'll eat not very good. I'll make bad food choices, but I'll just really exercise like crazy. I don't care how much you exercise. The diet is really probably the main component that's going to do that weight loss. And even with these newer medications, there's about 15%, maybe 20% that don't lose much weight. And again, they're eating through this.
So on the other side of that, can you talk a little bit about what we call in our practice super responders, right? So we have this average of whatever it's going to be, 10 or 15% body, but that's the average, right? So can you talk about the people that, both sides, the ones that are super responders or the ones that just don't seem, they're not affected at all?
Oh, super responders are just so fun to have because
they're our joy. They love you, right? Yes.
Right. I mean, at the end of the year, you wouldn't believe how many presents I get. This is great. So they're basically these super responders, which is a big portion. We're talking a third of the patients. That's how, again, how targeted these newer hormones are getting bariatric surgical weight loss numbers. In other words, the most common procedure is a sleeve gastrectomy. You get between 20 and 25%. Guess what? A third of the patients with the current GLP-1 for weight loss is getting over 20%. Oh my gosh. And the new ones coming out are going to be there or better. So again, I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime.
Right. I love it. I do. And that's, I think that's it. And you don't, it's hard. We were talking to someone else earlier and it's like, you can't predict who's going to be that super responder though. You can't look at the person and say, you gain your weight here or you we're born on a Tuesday. It's almost like that same other thing of genetic responses to these hormones, maybe. Do you have thoughts on that at all?
A little bit. And so when we were studying these compounds early on, and the first time we went to the FDA and showed them our data, they said, there's an awful lot of nausea with these GLP-1s. And I'm sure you guys see this all the time, especially if you treat diabetics. And what it is earlier I said the GLP-1 goes up to the brain, tells you to stop eating. You guys know it goes to the pancreas, releases insulin in response to high blood sugars, not to low, which is beautiful. But it also goes to the stomach and it slows gastric emptying. And when you slow gastric emptying enough, you feel nauseated. It's kind of like having the flu where your gastrum is just totally not moving at all. You can put your stethoscope, you won't hear a thing. So when you're titrating it, if the patient is getting a lot of nausea, they may end up being one of these super responders, but they're just really sensitive to the medication. So you got to go really slow on the titration. And unfortunately, some of these, when we did all the original old studies, we were doing what's called forced titration because it's an FDA. You just have to do it because that's what we wrote the protocol for the FDA. Now we're beginning, no, we shouldn't have done that. We should have gone very slow. And again, you as practitioners probably slow it down all the time because you don't want to lose the patient. And I tell you, they're losing weight. So we actually did one little analysis for the FDA on some of these drugs, looking at nausea versus weight loss. And it was hard to separate out, but you didn't have to have nausea to get really good weight loss. So you did fine there. But it does look like it just might be that little indicator that they're going to be very sensitive.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. It's almost like a good sign. You want to say, you know what, if you get a little nauseous, right? And I do believe you, when we use the drugs, we were actually writing a case study today, Diana and I, for a presentation. And, you know, this person complained of nausea after the first dose, after the first month. And it's like, well, leave them where they are. You can't back them down because they're at the lowest dose. Leave them there they are. Small, frequent meals, decrease the amount of fat if you can, right? And try to keep them on it and keep them going, because we know that nausea over time goes down. But the forced titration, I think, has turned a lot of people off. And then the other thing I think that you and I both talk about is 20% nausea. It means 80% not, right? And so I think when we present it the right way and talk about that presentation of, yes, some people do have nausea, but a lot of people don't, and they still lose weight, but also don't think you're going to get it, because then you're going to get the placebo effect and they're all going to come back with nausea. So I think that's an interesting, but what about our non-responders? What about people that don't seem to lose the same amount of weight? And what do you think the solution for those people is? Is it wait for the third hormone to come out, that third combo? Is it a different makeup?
So this is where you're going to have to, and this takes kind of advanced obesity medicine training, so to speak, because you're going to start looking at a couple things. But one is, it is very possible, and this population may be as high as 5% of the patient population that gets bariatric surgery, which, as you know, there's a lot of people who qualify for bariatric surgery. But the receptor up in the brain where these hormones go up is broken. So you can send up all the satiety signals you want. They don't get satiated. And so what you're looking for is, you want to get some history on these patients. When did the obesity start? If they were obese as a child, you got to start thinking, okay, we may be looking at one of these gene variants that's driving up weight. And you can do a genetic study, and there's all these companies out there with some of these newer drugs that are targeting that specific group, and they'll run the test for you, because again, they're just trying to find these patients. But so that's one thing. The other one is, as you probably know, it's not a lot, but there are people who eat for other reasons. In other words, what we call reward eating or cravings. And we're kind of fighting this out. At least I fight it out with a psychologist, because I don't like the term they use. They want to use the term hedonistic eating, which I get it. But I feel like we beat up people who struggle with weight so much every day that I like reward eating, or I like cravings much better. And what it is somebody starts telling you, you know, every day at, you know, 4 p.m, I'm home, I'm getting dinner ready for the family, but I just got to have some chocolate then, you know? And so they're a specific time, specific act they're doing, maybe getting the family ready for, you know, picking up kids at school, whatever, and a specific food. Now you got to think, okay, this is reward eating. This is a little bit different, because this doesn't run off the GLP-1 receptor, rather norepinephrine, dopamine, you know, the same reward that you get from drinking alcohol or jumping out of planes or whatever you like to do. So that can be a group. And in some psychological studies, they'll say that roughly 7% of the U.S. population is literally addicted to food. So they'll eat through these things, that group. So it's a small group, but it's there. Other folks find, you know, when they take these GLP-1s, that craving really goes away. So sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. It's just kind of, and again, this is almost more advanced than I'm supposed to know this area, but more advanced than we know what we're dealing with right now, that small group that doesn't respond.
Well, thanks so much for describing that. I mean, that's fascinating. And I really like the term reward eating over hedonistic eating, for sure. But I agree with you. People are beat up too much about their weight. Reward eating sounds better. Well, I want to thank you so much for the discussion. It's been amazing.
What an amazing discussion.
Yeah, that was really, really interesting.
And I think it's interesting to talk about coverage across the United States when he said in California, someone with Medicaid can get weight loss medication. I jumped out of my seat. What do you mean? You can, that is a great decision on that state's part.
It is definitely a great decision. I think, I mean, things need to be done for the cost of the medications as well. So I would love to see if there's anything that could be done, because the prices over the last few years have continued to go up. I mean, a GLP-1 agonist is about $1,000 per month. So it's a big cost, and we do see it's lower in other countries. So certainly any advocacy that could be done to lower the cost, but I love to see more insurance plans cover it.
Right. I do too. I think that will help drive our obesity rates in America are just going up and up and up. And I think that, isn't everything, but it's a big part of it.
It's a big part, because it was so fascinating about the discussion about set point. It really, unfortunately, people are kind of set up to fail, because it's like they lose weight, then they gain it, then they're burning less calories, their set point's off, they're eating the same amount as someone next to them with the same size, but they might gain weight with that amount of calories. And so people are just unfortunately not set up well. And then you add to that our food environment, where there's so much like fast food, processed food, and it's just really, really hard. And for the first time now, we actually have some tools to overcome this, that like actually overcome the biology of it and give people a fighting chance to lose the excess weight.
And do well, right. I also think that there really needs to be a focus when someone is going to use a GLP-1 to talk about diet, right? And talk about food and planning and increasing good calories, like high nutrient calories, where you're looking at, whole fruit and vegetables as often as possible with every meal and those kinds of things, and reducing that, like you said, that processed or fast food.
Yeah. What I really liked that he talked about was what I was sensing was that pairing of lifestyle changes with the drugs.
Right.
I mean, definitely the importance of that exercise, both aerobic and strength, to make sure that we're preserving muscle mass and how important that is. But also the whole food environment too. It'll make it easier to make healthy choices, but we still need to make sure we provide people with education about what healthy choices are. And I don't think everyone knows.
No.
And I think sometimes with the food labeling, it's hard to know, because labels will say, oh, like 100%, or they'll say, like, they'll,
right.
they'll
100% have, juice. That must
right.
be okay
that
for you,
That must
right?
sound great, right. but that's not, it's just going to spike blood sugar up really quickly.
Right.
Cereals have all this messaging on them.
Low sugar. Right.
Right. Are like heart healthy.
Right.
And really, it's like overly processed, and it's not such a healthy choice. So I think going back to the basics about whole grains and fruits and vegetables, and really meeting with a dietitian and getting that support to make healthy choices.
And it is almost like opening the door. This class of anti-obesity medications opens the door for treatment of obesity. And if we can couple that with lifestyle modifications, including exercise and diet, then can we exponentiate the weight loss if you have all of the components working together?
Right. The other thing I think really interesting now is this whole kind of idea of weight loss versus surgery.
Right.
And I think our guidelines have been really pro-surgery
right.
For a long time, because that's been the most effective tool that we've had in our toolbox. I mean, the weight loss in terms of like the years that people maintain that weight loss is very, very good. But now, really for the first time, we have drugs that may be comparable to the weight loss that we see with bariatric surgery. I guess time will tell the durability of it, like 20, 30, 40 years out. But so far, it's looking really, really good. And I love that now people may have that choice, surgery versus the drug therapy, because, I mean, undergoing surgery, even though it's been shown to be very safe, very effective, it's still surgery, and
right.
there still are risks.
There
I mean, we
are.
See people
Absolutely.
All the time with like post-bariatric hypoglycemia and other complications.
Right.
So I just like love that we're able to give people more choices.
And I think that, the close is that you can't stop it, right? If you think about these hormones as a way to send a message to the brain that you need, to say, this is enough food, you've had enough, that satiety level, and you stop it, what would you think would happen, right? We don't stop blood pressure
right.
medicine. We don't stop insulin, typically anyway, right? I mean, we don't stop those other things when we hit goal. We don't stop cholesterol medicine. Then we really should think about obesity injectable medications is a lifelong thing
because
of that hormone imbalance, right? We don't stop thyroid medication typically. We don't, right? We might address it and adjust those medications, but we typically don't stop them. I think that, you know, well, you have to take them for life. Is this messaging that is very negative where you're gonna be on that for the rest of your life, but it's really gonna help you. How about what we're, you know, and I'm looking forward to that cardiovascular risk reduction in obesity data that I'm hoping that we're gonna find. And I think that, you know, instead of saying it that way and talking to people like that or messaging like that, it's you get to be on this because it's gonna tell your brain this, it's gonna help reduce cardiovascular risk. Those kinds of discussions we can turn that into a very positive thing when talking to people.
I also wanna make sure we're taking into account, we're treating the obesity because of the potential complications, which we know are very likely, the things like the sleep apnea and the hypertension and the diabetes and the arthritis. But it's not that we want to be careful that we don't destroy people's body image. We're not saying that you don't look good the way that you are. It's not that at all. It's really about health. It's about being a chronic condition that we're trying to help.
Right. And after, you know, it's 10 years that obesity was recognized as its own disease process. And, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what else is coming in the next phase of GIP, GLP-1 receptor agonists.
Me too. It's a really exciting time.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for tuning in to this MedCast series.